This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
On tonight's show, we head to the Australian Open as we speak to their tournament director, Craig Tiley, about their announcement of Open for All, a wide-ranging equality, diversity and inclusion initiative that is being brought to life during this year's tournament. We learn about a new STI that is becoming resistant to antibiotics, Mycoplasma genitalium, or MG, and how a simple test can point towards effective treatment. And we speak to queer people of colour as they discuss constantly managing ignorance and racism, as well as how they are carved an inclusive space which celebrates queer people of colour's narratives, experiences and pride.
This is The Informer, Joy's nightly news and current affairs program. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS us on 0427 Joy 949, email on air at joy.org.au or add us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
A new Australian developed diagnostic test is set to be rolled out across the country for a little known sexually transmitted infection, which about 400,000 Australians are likely to have. Mycoplasma genitalium, or MG for short. MG can cause infertility and acts like a superbug and is resistant to most available antibiotics. Earlier today, The Informer's Dina Curie spoke to Associate Professor Katrina Bradshaw from the Melbourne Sexual Health Clinic about MG and asked, why are we only just hearing about it?
Mycoplasma genitalium is really a bacterial STI that is very similar to chlamydia. So it's associated with similar symptoms. So in men, it can cause urethral discharge and burning when they pee. In women, it can cause deep pain with sex, abnormal bleeding, lower abdominal pain. But like chlamydia, it's often asymptomatic. The difference to chlamydia, or one of the marked differences to chlamydia, is its propensity to develop antimicrobial resistance and its intrinsic resistance to commonly used antibiotics. So it lacks a cell wall, so it's intrinsically resistant to a number of common classes of antibiotics like penicillins and cephalosporins, and it's really only responds to a couple of available classes. So that's azithromycin and another class of drugs called quinolones. And when we started using azithromycin for Mycoplasma genitalium about 15 years ago, it worked really well. But over the last decade, it's developed increasing resistance to the point now that more than 50% of cases that are diagnosed are now resistant to azithromycin. Our second-line antibiotic, moxifloxacin, which is a quinolone, was also very successful when we started using it in about 2006, but we now have resistance to that in about 10 to 15% of cases. And quite alarmingly, in about sort of 8 to 9% of cases, we have resistance to both antibiotics, which leaves us with very limited treatment options.
So does this mean there's a lot of people carrying this or experiencing these symptoms, or it's just not able to be treated?
So we don't have surveillance for Mycoplasma genitalium, so we don't know exactly how common it is, but a number of pieces of evidence indicate it's as common, probably as common as chlamydia, and affects about 1 to 2% of the population. Now, in terms of symptoms, as I said, often people will be asymptomatic. We know that it tends to last a reasonable length of time in individuals. We don't have a lot of natural history data, and that's an area that's really needed. But it probably lasts for sort of 3 months plus in individuals, and in some cases we know it's lasted for over 2 years.
Right now, with the information that's been released today in press releases, the focus has been on making sure more protection is for women. What's the priority for us to make sure women are getting the treatment that they need to fight MG?
The emphasis has been on women only because the media release was from the Royal Women's Hospital and that deals with women. So at Melbourne Sexual Health Centre, we see both men and women, and men are equally affected by mycoplasma genitalium, and in fact we find that gay men are probably disproportionately affected by mycoplasma genitalium, which we see at the moment for other STIs like syphilis and gonorrhea. So it's of equal importance in men and women. The only difference is that women have an upper genital tract that puts them at far greater risk of serious complications. So things like preterm delivery, pelvic inflammatory disease, infertility. So these are things that men really don't have to worry about. But that's really why there's been an emphasis on women in the press releases today.
That was Katrina Bradshaw with Dean Curie. Up until now, most GPs have not had access to a test to diagnose the disease and have guessed at which class of antibiotics to use, leading to Mycoplasma genitalium having resistance to most antibiotics. Chris Williams contracted MG and spoke to us earlier today about his treatment.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
It was September in 2016 that I found out that I had acquired mycoplasma genitalium, also known as MG. It was the first time that I'd really heard anything of its nature, and it was originally a casual sex partner that notified me that he had acquired this thing called MG, or MG for short, and I didn't really know anything about it at the time, and he didn't know a lot either. He was having a pretty rough time dealing with it in terms of he was having symptoms and he was also having side effects from some of the treatment that he was being given, but he encouraged me at that point to go and get a test for it, which I did, and it came back positive. I was completely asymptomatic, so I had no idea at all that I was carrying anything of that nature. But for me personally, when I've had things like chlamydia and gonorrhea before, I've also never had any symptoms of that. So it's not necessarily surprising for me as an individual. Some guys do get symptoms, some guys don't. It was a very strange process to go through and realise that I've acquired something that doesn't seem to be on the radar. Certainly the common sexual health channels for information that I would go to, you know, those websites, those Facebook feeds, those kind of things where I would be able to get information, they weren't talking about that. So that was a little concerning, first of all. And certainly dealing with the GPs also didn't seem to know a huge amount about it at that time, especially in terms of how to treat it. But I did know that certainly MG was something that was very resistant to a lot of first-line treatments, and that kind of added to my anxiety at the time. Now, where we're at now in terms of understanding MG a few years later, it's not necessarily as concerning as that. It's certainly not a great thing, but there are treatment options available. For me, in my case, the way that it worked was that they performed a special test and a resistance test. So that test is able to identify, first of all, whether somebody has MG or doesn't have MG, a confirmed diagnosis. It's also in the same test able to identify whether that particular strain of MG is resistant to frontline treatment, azithromycin. Azithromycin is an antibiotic used for various other treatments, to other types of STIs, but we know that certainly some strains of MG are completely resistant to it already, so therefore there's no point treating somebody with azithromycin for that. So in my case, they gave me a week's worth of doxycycline, which was intended to kind of weaken the bacterial infection, and then immediately after that, I started on another week of a stronger antibiotic called cytofloxacin. It's one of maybe three or four, I think, antibiotics that are kind of second-line ones that can be used to treat MG. Going for regular tests is an important part of managing your sexual well-being in any case, but certainly for most gay and bisexual men, we're offered standard tests for things such as HIV, Hep C, syphilis, chlamydia, gonorrhea. Those are the kind of the standard tests that we do, as well as vaccinations for Hep A and Hep B. But MG is not currently offered as standard, but you can, if you're concerned, request a test from your GP. But certainly at the moment, the recommendation is if you've been notified by a sexual partner partner that you may have acquired MG or they have acquired MG, then you can request a test. But at the moment, it's not necessarily something that we're encouraging people to proactively test for.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
Last Friday, the Australian Open named tennis legend and tireless human rights campaigner Billie Jean King as Tennis Australia's Woman of the Year at a special event during Better Together 2018. At the event, Australian Open director Craig Tiley announced Open for All, a wide-ranging equality, diversity and inclusion initiative that will be brought to life during this year's tournament. Open for All includes a series of special events designed to celebrate the fairness and equality of tennis, which welcomes everyone regardless of their race, gender, sexuality or ability. We spoke to Craig Tiley earlier today and asked if such a strong message of inclusion from the sport was spurred on by the comments of Margaret Court last year, where she voiced her controversial views on the LGBTI communities and on same-sex marriage.
Tennis is a sport that has a good history of inclusivity and celebrating diversity and equality. And in the area of equality, for example, 1984, we've paid equal prize money for men and women. And we've always celebrated the diversity of our sport. And then more recently, there's some comments that were made by one of our greats around a certain position which we didn't agree with, and we just felt that we just wanted to accentuate, not specifically because of that, but just for the public, we want to accentuate the fact that it's a magnificent sport when it comes to inclusivity and diversity. And while we've done these things right throughout the year, celebrating and funding and supporting it, we decided this year that we were just going to be more outward and more public about that. You know, we immediately came out publicly as well as contacted Margaret. So look, our values and are not aligned with what she was saying, and we vehemently disagreed with her position. Obviously, she's entitled to free speech. She's entitled to say what she says, but it doesn't necessarily put us in a position where we agree with it or not, and we didn't agree with it, and we're very clear. And particularly because we are a sport that that has been inclusive in our approach to everything. And then there was, ongoing public debate and comment on it. And then we wanted to play initially our role in the marriage equality debate and be one of the first sports to come out publicly and say that we believe that this is 100% the right thing to do and we should be acting now. And then also one of the iconic leaders of inclusivity globally has been Billie Jean King. And this year, 2018, is 50 years since she won the Australian Open. And she's a friend of mine. And I contacted her and asked if she would love to come out for 2 weeks. She must celebrate the great work that she's done for not only for equality, but for ensuring that our sport is inclusive and open. And it's been fantastic to have her. Not that easy to always get such an icon to fly out from the US and come down to Melbourne this time of the year. And particularly Billie Jean is extremely busy, and she's got the Billie Jean King Leadership Initiative, which she's launched to help particularly women. And so we've partnered with that as well. And we asked her to, as the part of the launch our Open for All campaign these 2 weeks, we asked her to launch it. And we did in partnership with the Better Together group and their workshop. And Ro Allen's been fantastic, our commissioner at Victoria, and helping drive that. And the whole idea over the course of these 2 weeks is to raise money, and also in partnership with the state government, but to raise money for the Pride Centre in St Kilda. And we hope, I don't know how much we're going to raise, but these 2 weeks we're going to be aggressive with it, and we're going to continue to do it throughout the year. This is just not a two-week position of our organisation, but... But that night was a fantastic night, and I think Billie Jean said some great things and then spent some time afterwards talking to everyone.
Open for All highlights events include a Battle of the Sexes celebrity match inspired by Billie Jean King, and the Melbourne Grand Slam at Melbourne Park as part of Midsummer Festival, where all players, regardless of their gender, race, religion and sexual orientation, are welcome to play on the clay courts alongside Vic Tennis.
I can say right from the beginning, this is just natural for us. It's not something that, sometimes these things, they can be done with an ulterior objective in mind. Ours is not. We have a very diverse workforce. There's 550 employees. For the Australian Open, we employ 9,500 people. And I, as leading the organisation, I want to ensure that we are a sport, we are an organisation that embraces and celebrates diversity, inclusivity, and ensures that we play our part in the community to support anyone who feels that tennis is not including them, or tennis is not providing them with the diversity that we talked about. So it's just to raise, in the most important way, is to raise the profile of it. And we have a great platform because we're launching the sport to the rest of the world. We're actually launching the sporting entertainment season for the world here in January, because we'll have over 1 billion people watching it. We'll have thousands of people come through the gate. So it's a great platform for us to do that. And also we're tennis, which is a sport which has a long history of celebrating it. So
after Margaret Court spoke out last year against our communities, many people began bringing rainbow flags to the tennis in opposition to her comments, something that Tilly is happy to see continue during this year's tournament as a point of celebration, inclusiveness and equality.
And we love that. We welcome that. And it adds to the colour, and it adds to the general attitude that we all live together and we support and help each other, and there's no discrimination based on anyone. So I'm not too sure about this in Australia, but certainly compared to the other Grand Slams and other tennis events globally who don't allow flags, we're one of the only ones that actually do. We want people to come to the tennis, and we want them to express their individuality and express their views. Obviously, if it's offensive, we have to act on that. But we want people to come out and have a good time, and we think the flags are really a big part of that. Every single day we're having an open for all event, and the idea, the ultimate objective, is to raise money for the Pride Centre. The thing I'm most proud of is that our entire organisation has got behind this, and I think that, you know, it's the LGBTIQ community is, unless there's the organisation, and not only with its staff but also with all the stakeholders involved, it has a public position relative to how inclusive we need to be and how diverse we need to be. Unless we celebrate that, then it gets forgotten. So I think I'm particularly proud. So when you talk about a specific event that is highlighted, I think I'm particularly proud of how everyone's embraced it and actually of volunteering their time to work in all these events. And then, of course, next Thursday, the inspirational series, we've got guest speakers. Billie Jean King's one of our guest speakers. Alan Joyce is another one. And we're bringing in a large group of people. We have about 600 people that are going to have a lunch, a small conference and a workshop talking about these issues. And then also, if everyone goes to the tennis, and we're going to celebrate in the stadium all those people that have played a leadership role with the work around equality and inclusivity. And I think that's going to be a fun event. And that's going to be, you know, again, a high-profile event. And we're really excited about that. And I think the other thing I'll say, these are all activities we have planned well before there was the vote on equality in Australia, and we were ready to position ourselves in case things were not going to go well, position ourselves to be very public about how it needed to change.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, your news program from an LGBTI perspective.
LGBTI spaces that are meant to be welcome all in our community can be uncomfortable for people of colour. But is it the spaces, or is it how we are treating others? Though we are part of one community, there is still separation within another. With white visuals and model dominations, our expressions and promotion, sometimes you can forget the simple fact that queer people of colour face further oppression than are members of the white LGBTI communities. The Informer's Dina Curie spoke to Tyrone, who shares with us his experiences working and experiencing Australian queer spaces and how oppression still continues, even within our marginalised communities.
I think that when I'm moving to Australia, to me, it feels no different than being back home in Madison, Wisconsin. I think that it's very, what do I want to say, segregated in a way. I feel that, especially at the bar that I work at, it seems very, I would say most of my clientele at the bar is like a good like 90% Caucasian men. And I think that it's very hard to intertwine, because it seems like you, to get to know people, they kind of see you as a fetish, or there has to be some kind of interest in there, but it's just been very difficult. I've noticed with like, and even like going out in public, it's like people kind of, you definitely feel the eyes on you when you walk into a space that is mainly a Caucasian space, that it feels like. Even on the train, it just feels like you can just feel the eyes on you and feel people as you walk by. It's just been very interesting since moving here. Because as queer folk, we are segregated against, and we are, you know, people are against us our whole lives from the moment we come out or who we are. But then going into a gay space where it's supposed to be all inclusive and everybody's supposed to love each other and it's supposed to be about happiness and celebration. But then when you really get into the breakdown of let's say each separate community, like bear community, leather community, blah, blah, really it's all the same. Because even though everyone tries to be inclusive, there's always people in the group that are not such. And usually those people that are not are like somewhere in the committee of such or somewhere in power of there. So, I mean, it's definitely, it's just very interesting that like even as queer folk, we still treat our own as hetero people treat us. There isn't a day that I'm not talking about it. Even when I go back home to Madison, where I teach queer youth for like a youth leadership camp I do for 3 weeks, I'm always talking about it consistently. And I always get asked questions. Subjects always come up, and especially being an American citizen in a different country with what's happening in my country, it's definitely something that's always brought to my attention.
What do you say to people when you have to constantly keep bringing up your race in queer spaces?
Honestly, it's to a point where I tell people it's not my job to educate you. It is not my purpose in life to sit here and try to tell you everything so that you can attempt to understand, but still at the end of the whole conversation, not understand a thing I'm saying. If you want to be educated, well, I have no problem sharing my experiences with people, but it's when it becomes a consistent thing, and sometimes with the same people. It's like, you know, you can read a book, you can read articles online, you could look at YouTube videos, you could take a college course. There's plenty of things. It's just, it's not colored people's purpose to keep educating people about how it is for us.
Do you think we're in a time now, we're talking about queer people of color a lot more, we're seeing a lot more exposure to their experiences within our medium, but people still aren't accessing it or grabbing hold of it?
That's a tricky question, because because I think that what happened with the whole pride flag adding on two other colors, the black and brown, and then it took for the queer community to talk about racism. But it took for such a big thing for people to be offended about, to be like, okay, well, here's a problem. There's racism within the queer community that we need to talk about. It always takes some huge event for people to wake up. And then it's talked about, but it's not talked about enough. And it's only talked about if there's a person of color within that circle. Then it really gets down and dirty with the questions and stuff. But like, it's not talked about how it should be, not openly at least. I think that people are also afraid to ask. I make myself very open when it comes to if you want to ask me questions as well. But I mean, it's still, it makes people are just afraid to ask questions. If you have a question, I will answer it. But if you keep, like, it's like you keep consistently coming back to me, because I've had people that have done that here. It's not my job to keep telling you and keep trying to share everything that happens, because I end up feeling like your token friend or your token like advisor in a sense.
Were you surprised that this is what it was like here in Australia when you came here?
Before I moved here, I visited here three months, a couple summers ago. And some of my friends that had lived here before had told me about their experiences, and they were people of color. And when I got here, it's more of like I wasn't shocked, but there were just some things I was shocked about. And I think just more so in the queer community, I was more shocked about things. Like when you go to some of the bars where they do promotions of like events, they only promote all the posters they have around the bar are all of white men, like all of them. And it's really frustrating when you have like all these beautiful men of color, and it doesn't just mean black, it means any kind of shade of color around here, and it's just all white men promoted everywhere. People only recognize it when you bring it to their attention.
What could you say to people who are listening about what they can do or to be more aware of what people of color go through in these spaces and how they can change?
I would say pay attention. I would say listen to what's going on in the world, but in the news, even chit-chat that's going in the bars, but then also realize that, as I've said before, and it may sound a little contradictory, that it's not color folks' job to educate you on what's going on in the society of such. Because if the conversations are happening, you just have to pay attention and chime in and have a voice.
A space that celebrates queer people of colour in Australia is the Cocoa Butter Club, celebrating queer performers of colour and giving a voice to the other. Promoting the fact that performers of colour are creating in a multitude of mediums and hold a mirror to productions asking if they are encouraging performances of colour and the messages that their art carries. Danny Weber and Anna tell us about this space, about what this space means to them, and how celebrating people of colour in this way shines an important light on something that is missing.
And something I'm super proud of is to be co-producer of the Cocoa Butter Club, which is a performance night for Indigenous and or people of colour. Anyone is welcome to attend, but only people of colour are performing, and they're allowed to be as political, unapologetic as they want. And if white people attend, that's great, and often they like kind of sit towards the back and listen, and the MCs actually talk lots about anti-racism and the struggles they face. So I've heard from many people who are people of colour, it's the first time they've attended or performed at a space that was that supportive and where they were in the majority. And for many white people, they might find it a bit confronting, but that discomfort is good and they just sit with it, which is amazing.
I recently went to the second ever Cocoa Butter Club night held in Melbourne. That was a pretty excellent experience. I went to the first night as well, and the MCs for the night, one of the MCs was Nayuka Gori, and she was being really, really real about the way that white people were inhabiting the space that night. And, you know, it was a different kind of thing because it was like cabaret seating and stuff. But whenever she got up to speak, she talked about Elijah Dowji and encouraged people to come to the protest and would point things out like, why were there white people sitting on chairs when a bunch of POC people were sitting on the floor? And when the last act was playing, which was Wahe, they invited people of color to come to the front of the stage. And that was like a pretty powerful thing as well. It was amazing because Nayuka is a very funny person, but also would control the crowd in a way where she'd specifically tell people, why are you laughing at that? That's not a joke. Like, if you're uncomfortable, sit with the discomfort. But then again, like, Nayuka shouldn't have to do those things. She shouldn't have to put the labor in.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
That's it for another episode of The Informer, bringing you news and current affairs for Australia's LGBTI communities. A podcast of tonight's show will be available to download soon at joy.org.au or on your preferred podcast platform. Don't forget to follow us on social media at The Informer on Joy949 on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter. If you have a story or tip and would like to share it with us, get in touch at theinformer.joy.org.au. You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. I'm Josh Pearson. Good night.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.